Hey PTs, are you maxed out on hours? You tired of endless patient notes? Still chipping away at those student loans? PTLive.me is an on-demand patient clinic hub helping licensed PTs get ahead of the rat race. Stay tuned for more or check out PTLive.me.
This is the PT Pintcast. A podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer. Bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
How are you doing?
Doing well. And yourself?
Good, mate. Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. You've brought my evening to me sooner, so I've got a beer in front of me at 4 p.m., which is good for me.
Well, I'm at noon, man, so I'm really hitting it hard.
I like it. No, thanks for having me, mate. I think it's a really good show. I think it's got some real potential, and I think you're already fulfilling that pretty strongly. Some great,
cool.
Great ideas in a really nice manner that you can just really tell that you're a pro. And I think that that's something that I've learned a lot from with my show, just listening to yours and recognizing the manner and the real art form that you bring to it.
Well, let's get started. I mean, you're a podcaster. We've already just started in. So the best conversations that happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Jack Chu on the show. He has his very own podcast. Been doing podcasting over across the pond, the Physio Matters podcast, since, the end of 2013, and just uploaded his 27th episode. And you can find them on iTunes or his website, which is choosehealth.co.uk. Jack, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me, Jimmy. Nice to finally get chatting.
So the first question is always the hardest here. What are we drinking today?
So I've managed to get myself, I'm afraid I'm a large a drinker, usually the common stuff, and I'm drinking a Peroni. Myself and a colleague of mine, really into Peroni, trying to raise awareness as well for the unknown condition of Peroni's disease. That's one for Google.
Peroni's a good beer. I've had that before. Italian, right?
Yeah, that's right.
It's a good beer. In America, we love today. March 17th is St. Patrick's Day. I'm pretty sure it's a bigger deal in America than it is in Ireland, so I'm going with the Guinness. They have a new Guinness Blonde American Lager, so mixing the Irish St. Patrick's Day with the American Lager.
Nice. Well, no, it is a big deal over here as well, but didn't have any knocking around in the old beer fridge. So yeah, I'm on the Italian stuff today.
Well, any beer is a good beer, especially on St. Patrick's Day. So let's dive right in. Been listening to your show since before I started my podcast. Figured I would absorb as many podcasts as possible, even well before I had the idea. I like the fact that we take kind of a different approach to things. In terms of, I'm a student, you're a practicing physio. So cool, we're kind of on the opposite ends of spectrums there. You release an episode a month, and you've been doing that since December of 2013, where I started out not knowing what the hell I was doing. So I was like, well, I'm just going to talk to as many people as possible. And I think that shows where we both are in our careers, where I'm a student, I'm just running around listening to anybody who will talk to me, where you've been doing it for a while, and you're able to say, we're going to sit down, and you have a team, and we sit down and we talk about, okay, what do we want to get at? What are we going to delve into? What are we going to talk about? Are we going to talk around? And you can kind of approach your episodes that way. So I kind of like the fact that we do the same thing, a physio podcast, but we do it really differently.
Absolutely, no, for sure. And I think that's pretty evident. But I think it probably comes across as if we're more organized than we are, but also it's definitely become more organized over time. So initially, it was a bit of a pilot project. Yes, I had some colleagues helping me out a little bit with it, more sort of encouraging me and potentially throwing me under the bus. But essentially what happened in time was it developed and it grew its own identity. And when it took off and we started to feel a bit more responsible for what we were broadcasting, we started to formalize it a little bit, hopefully not formalizing ourselves on the air, but definitely starting to put things together to make sure that we were bringing a balanced journalistic approach to things.
Yeah, you really do take it. I mean, we had a couple conversations via Twitter and via email. You really do take the audience into account in terms of you really want to put forth the best product, and that's when you know you've got something, is when people are giving you feedback, either positive or negative, and you can kind of take it and turn it into something a little bit better than it was the episode or the month before, and grow it.
Definitely. Well, that's it. You can't really do anything with it until you start to get the feedback to start moving forward and understanding that feedback, really trying to see what people want, but also pandering not just to what they want, but what they might need as well. I think that was the thing that we tried to do fairly boldly, speaking to true experts, and not taking it as being just us against the world. You know, we needn't be militant about this. Let's talk to people about topics that know much more about it than we do.
One thing that we had discussed talking about was spectrums, clinical or political spectrums that can go from extremism, criticizing ideas rather than people. I mean, I feel like that happens especially on Twitter when you criticize the person rather than the idea. That can get you in trouble.
It can, yeah. Well, I mean, it's a difficult one, and I think that it can be said that it starts to at least become more serious than it needs to be. I suppose I admittedly have to say I am serious about the topic, and I think that physiotherapy as a progressive entity, I think is serious and it's important, but I don't try and take myself or what we do too seriously. But one of the things that happens definitely is the general rules of engagement, I think, are getting spoiled in some ways in what has happened with the fact that there's so much access to information, which you'd think would be just wholly positive, but it can have its downsides. In that especially students and new graduates can be somewhat exposed to these spectrums and not necessarily know where they want to put themselves. And so when I say about spectrums, if I use an example on a clinical sense, is that you can have extremism at one end of a spectrum with evangelism at the other. And the idea there being, although you can spin it both ways, but extremism you could say would be someone that's being quite the maverick or doing something that is counter to everything that everyone else is doing, which you might think is edgy, but also counter to general consensus, very quite radical thinking. So we think out there in terms of, say, energy medicine, or to be suggesting people that they can be influenced by, say, astrology, or let's say that someone's horoscope is the main factor affecting their back pain. That's pretty out there, certainly lacks evidence. But on the flip side, you might have evangelism being someone that is only interested in the written work that is being done, or is holding and championing nice guidelines, for example, or the frameworks in which research has brought through, and holding that up as if it is a doctrine that needs to be followed. And that's why I call that, say, evangelism. And of course, most people are trying to work out where on that middle ground they sit. And in doing so, can get really complicated, because really those things I've just mentioned are ideas, and therefore those ideas need to be criticized in a sensible way. And the people that talk about those ideas or champion those ideas, of course, they can be questioned as people, but only because those people are the ones that are spouting those ideas. And it gets very difficult. You don't criticize them as a person, you're criticizing their ideas. And that starts to get very gray.
You bring up this being a problem for students and new graduates is because there's so much information out there that we will read anything that's printed. So it often is whoever's either blogging the most or screaming the loudest gets the most attention. And it's like, well, maybe that's not the best way to do it. But when we have nothing else to grab onto, so if the guy's screaming the loudest or screaming the most often, we do tend to grab onto that, and that's not necessarily the best way to do it.
Well, yeah, but that's no fault of yours, is it? I mean, the fact that you guys are out there looking for it, searching for it, trying to be a sponge is fantastic. You know, that's the sort of enthusiasm that we don't want to thwart. And don't for a second think that I'm wanting to, not that you would, but others might think that I'm trying to police that enthusiasm. Absolutely not. But I think we have a responsibility as a profession and as qualified staff that really want to try and develop you guys and see you as the future, to try and help to calibrate that learning and really help people to understand that the loudest voices are usually further away from the center, because it's interesting. You know, the interesting counter narrative to an extremist might be evangelical and vice versa. And so standing in the middle ground needn't be boring. And that's what we're trying to do, especially with Physio Matters, particularly more recently with the projects we're having spinning off it. Although it's not difficult, the ideas that get shouted about, it's almost easier to talk about the ideas as if they're completely neutral, but ideas don't exist in a vacuum, right? So when ideas are championed on a regular basis by individuals or groups, there's no need to be disparaging about it. You're still talking about the idea, but equally that person does get tied into it sometimes, or does get held account to some of their words, and that's important. And so although it's not difficult, I think it is super important for helping you guys, especially the students and new grads, to try and get that measure.
So easy. I mean, there's some individuals, their topics might be something like dry needling, and they might want to jump onto it, and it just seems like they just try to yell and scream and hammer home their personal opinion. They want to just post links to specific research, and it really is easy for a student to then just glom onto that, grab onto it with both hands and never let go. And that's hard to sift through everything that's out there, especially when you're just trying to learn. All I'm trying to learn is the basics right now. I'm just trying to master the basics. And that's very, very difficult. And now you've got the different stuff going on with people who have been doing this for a while. And it's hard to either ignore or agree with wholeheartedly with someone like that.
Absolutely. And I think that the only real way in which those things can be measured, you're trying to read everything, but you literally can't read everything.
Can't.
And so you end up, and this is one of the things that it's probably 12 months ago, I wrote a blog on Adam Meakin's page, with part of it, only part of it, but the thing that got criticized most was this idea for the right to entertain. You know, if there's that much information out there, we've still got a right to try and can still be presented in an attractive way without it being too radical. And that's a real difficult thing. And there's certain movements, certain people that are trying to promote things in making simple things sexy, and it's difficult, but it's important. It can get rather aggressive. So where the clinical spectrum meets the political spectrum is the idea that, let's say, another spectrum will be a very progressive person who's radically or militantly trying to provoke change. On the flip side, you've got someone that would be very conservative or settled to suggest that, no, everything's fine, everything's going in the right direction. Now, where I would sit on that spectrum would certainly be to the progressive side of centre there. I think that we need to keep moving things forward. I think that change is due. I think the data and the statistics suggest that things like persistent pain or general musculoskeletal problems that are disabling people are on the rise across the world, particularly the Western world. So I'd certainly be progressive, but I wouldn't necessarily be militantly progressive. That's where it's very difficult to find that line and that balance.
It's difficult, especially when you bring up like the right to entertain, especially with something like what you're doing and what I'm doing. You've got a guy like Eric Mara and J.W. Matheson. They've got a podcast where they essentially just bring on a piece of research. It's their journal club podcast. And they essentially just discuss things. That's being as neutral as you can, because they're human and they have to put a spin on it. Mm. I like what you guys are doing, and I want to make sure, especially the American students and PTs, know you guys actually foster a good amount of spirited debate about a topic. I remember listening to the KT tape debate. You'll bring on people who are on both sides of a coin, and surprisingly, no punches are thrown. People just discuss it, and you guys talk about a topic, and in the end, you know, you listen to someone else's information, and maybe you're smarter because of it. That's a good separator for your podcast, and your angle is you're really just trying to say, hey, here's a thing people are talking about. Let's talk about it. You're bringing in people who have a different take on it altogether.
And that's the thing that makes that work. And that was a great example you've used there, is because the person that in that debate, Paul Coker, is certainly pro-tape, but he's not necessarily particularly out there. So I could certainly have had a debate that wouldn't have been as favourable. So me and the Pauls went for a few beers afterwards, and I just know full well that they get on well now, because they weren't necessarily that distant. They were simply just one side of a fence on that spectrum. Had we have had someone that determines it to be morally deplorable to go near any tape,
right,
and I put them next to someone that thinks that the act of taping is the only thing that it should be done, and it's going to solve world peace, then essentially you're going to have some fireworks. And I think what the difficulty is, and one of the things that, you know, I keep saying about this idea that students and new grads, not to try and say that you need wrapping in cotton wool, but to hear those two Pauls discussing and debating things is somewhat different to having someone that is unrebutted talking about things in a manner that are what I would consider quite far on one side or the other of spectrum. And how I would calibrate that would be through evidence and the understanding of that. Now, through no fault of yours and new grads, what on earth would you wouldn't understand exactly where general consensus is, because you're trying to work it out yourself. That's just a really difficult thing that can be measured. And so when I'm interviewing, I'm always interviewing people that are far smarter than me. But if I'm not necessarily in light of all the information, I just try to err towards saying, what's the usual counter to that? You know, if I'm interviewing an academic on a topic that they know an awful lot about, saying, you know, who's not agreeing with you? You know, and what are they saying?
Right.
Or trying really to force myself to be the devil's advocate, because otherwise everything sounds so attractive. As much as that's a nice way to be and we could all nod along, it's very challenging when really things can get quite radical or quite out there.
Quite one-sided. We talked about that or flirted with that idea a little bit about bringing on, similar to what you had done for that for a couple episodes, which is bring on two people who happen to be on two different sides of the same fence. And I remember sitting there thinking, I didn't want to get in the middle because doing an interview like that is difficult. If it sounds easy and it sounds really easy to listen to, what some people may not know if they're not podcasting or doing things like this is it actually is very hard to structure a conversation that's easy to listen to. So kudos to you for being able to do that, but it's very, very difficult.
No, I think that's a great point, Jimmy. I think it's fun because Adam Meekins, I know he came on your show, did Adam, and I'd call him a good friend of mine. He might disagree with me, but generally I think we get on pretty well. But when I spoke to Adam on the first episode of his podcast, and we talked about podcasting, which I think cropped up in your interview with Adam.
Yep.
Generally speaking, the reason that rings a bell is because he was wanting to produce a podcast, and I'm sure he'd admit this to you. He was wanting to produce a podcast that was going to be quite out there. The things that he thought were being said off microphone on my podcast, the things that where you just let rip or really elicit someone's deep-rooted emotions. Now, what Adam's then gone on to find, and I'm sure he'll be comfortable saying this, is that, yes, sometimes those emotions do exist, but they don't probably exist quite as ferociously as Adam might think they do, just because that's his character. But also that trying to get those things teased out, or people wanting to put that out there for everyone to listen to as if it's a massive deal to them. They don't want to do that. And also it's a very difficult conversation to have with someone when you're trying to promote their work generally. If there's 10% that you might disagree with that might be more out there, more radical, to try and really probe into that in a more aggressive manner, it just doesn't work. And so Adam's podcast looks rather like what we would call a poor man's physio matters.
it's very difficult because while someone might rant and rave off mic, as we would say it, when you put a microphone in front of them and then you say, I'm going to say who you are, I'm going to introduce you, you're going to have to stand behind these statements. Often people back away just a little bit. They aren't as radical because it does. After you do it for a while, it takes a lot of energy to defend every radical thing that you'd say or produce.
Quite rightly so as well. I mean, I think that's a good way in which things can be socially monitored, isn't it? The way the people can be outrageous, but then when called to account for it, they might soften their view. And I think that's good. I think one of the things that when we talked about spectrums and it will stand out is the idea when I said about progressive versus settled, people that are more comfortable being more neutral or being less vocal about these things. I think a misconception is that because I decide to be that side, the more progressive side of the fence, that I'm trying to suggest that everyone should be like me. And God forbid, I really don't want that. You know, people don't want to all be doing that. But essentially, it's more about me just really trying to be myself, both in person and online. And that's a really difficult thing to be. And so I have a natural sort of brashness to me and to my personality, but I wouldn't want everyone trying to migrate towards that style because that's not them. So I'm just trying to be genuine, trying to be humble, trying to admit that that's me, but that doesn't make me a monster just because I'm being a little more outrageous than someone that's deciding to not necessarily provoke change quite as much.
What was the factor that said, you know, I'm going to do a podcast? Because I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you do at Choose Health. Did some research on your website, and you guys do things a little bit differently. Physiotherapy, but you also do some consultancies. It's like you're like a professional second opinion.
We'll certainly go into the Choose Health thing, but I suppose they are intimately linked with Physiomatters being the educational facet, rather annoyingly charitable facet of the business, which is a thorn in my accountant's side, certainly. Essentially, the podcast turned out because we were, myself and my other half, were commuting quite a lot, really, and I got a new iPhone. So I wonder if anyone's doing a physio podcast, just because there happened to be an app on that. And in doing so, I found an Australian podcast, got a lot to thank him for, a guy called David Pope, running a podcast called Physio Edge. Mm-hmm. So I listened to a couple of those on my long drive. There was a couple of podcasts that really stood out for me, and one of them just really changed the way in which I treated lateral hip pain. It was phenomenal. And in doing so, I realized just the beauty that medium could have. And then, but that didn't necessarily think I want to do that. Not long afterwards, I then listened to one which was, it was very difficult to listen to because it was so contrary to everything I come to understand about pretty much everything my mentors had ever told me. Everything that I was reading was saying something different. And I thought, this is going somewhat unrebutted. And that wasn't necessarily Dave's fault. Sometimes it was being sold so convincingly, and we'll talk a few examples on that, not necessarily specifically on those podcasts. But what it did is it made me then, as soon as I brought it home, my better half then says to me, well, could you do better? As you can already tell, I witter on a little bit, and I'm quite opinionated. And in doing so, it made me think, well, maybe I could. And I do have an ounce of journalistic history. And so I decided to take what I'm interested in, which is linguistics and language and the media generally, and thought I'd try and put that together. Did a few episodes, put them out there, the rest is history. And so it really took off from there because we've got quite a broad appeal. I think physiotherapists might mainly listen, but also a lot of different musculoskeletal professionals. And we even get patients or patient advocacy groups that listen on a regular basis. And so once it took off, that's when we started to formalize things. But it does fit the same model as the Choose Health thing. I think what happened was everything we do with the business is fueled by clinical gaps. And so what I'd done there is I'd realized that there were these physio podcasts out there which were brilliant, but the gap was that it wasn't necessarily being critiqued or forcibly balanced, if we could say that. So that's why Physio Matters was born. Choose Health started as a consultancy company because I was realizing that, say you came out of uni and you went into work for a sports club, you were doing so, say, part-time, not necessarily always paid, some voluntary work, and you were immersing yourself in it, wanting to see bodies, wanting to get the mileage in. And in doing so, you were sometimes then left quite isolated. So I'm speaking as if a hypothetical situation, but of course these things happen in real time. So particularly in the UK rugby and football clubs, these new grads were coming out and having these athletes that they were working with, and they were doing pretty well, you know, they'd get them going again. But now and again, there'd be a more complex thing that occurred and it wasn't quite going so well. Coaches would get on their back, the clubs were getting on their back. Now, what happens in those situations is there's a lot of pressure with no support. And so at best, what happens is a second opinion is sourced from a local private practice. Now, that's all well and good because that might, well, there's quite some experienced staff there and they might get the athlete better. But there's nothing that person, that physiotherapist, hasn't learned anything from it. That club physio hit their head against the ceiling and couldn't seem to get anywhere. So it got outsourced and they didn't learn anything. Mm-hmm. All we did was said, why, instead of you sending the patient or the athlete out, why don't we come in? And so it became a collaboration. Why don't we talk to the coaches? Why don't we talk to the physios? Why don't we talk to the player? Why don't we assess this as a team? And more often than not, we found ourselves going in there, basically getting the back of the new graduate or not necessarily always a new graduate, by the way, that's probably unfair of me to say, but just someone that's isolated, that's the main thing. Usually we go and get their back and explain to the staff that it's probably not okay that you're expecting this PCL to play rugby. It only happened 2 weeks ago. This is what's shaping up to be a rupture. This needs more rehab. And usually just explaining to them biological timeframes or usual timeframes that you'd expect. And once we did that, again, it took off because it filled a gap.
It's a unique model, and I think it's cool. People can check out more information about it online, choosehealth.co.uk, and from there you can check out all about your setup there and a link to the Physio Matters podcast. Are you still having fun doing it? That's got to be an important thing. You still having fun doing it? I mean, you've been doing it since 2013, 27 episodes in.
I really enjoy it. I think I'm very fortunate to have the support of when other bits of the business start getting busier. I'm very lucky to have a team to fall back on and the plotting and scheming, because what it can't be, and this is super important, as I'm sure you know, is that it can't be the gospel according to Chew.
Right.
So it can't just be this biased radio broadcast that's just going out there with one side. And so we have people regulating me and people regulating them.
That's what I'm looking for, is because I kind of had this idea. I have one classmate who handles the website. He does all like the background work, and that's what he loves. He's not looking to get on the mic. But I'm constantly asking people for, did you listen to that episode? Not because I want another download. I want to know, like, I don't even want to know I did right. What did I do wrong? What could I have done? What should I have done? And the funny part was, a lot of people step back from that because they don't want to put they don't think they know enough. And I'm like, trust me, you know enough. If you consumed it and you listened to it critically, you know enough.
Well, what we're doing over in the UK and Ireland at the moment is, off the back of one of the things we did, which was a side project that started called Physio Natters, is that we're trying to get some student involvement, because there's a number of things, a number of gripes that people have with their courses and things like that. And it can come across as if it's just a big whinge if they were to try and raise that, particularly if they try and raise that publicly. But also, if there are changes that need to be instigated, then, you know, let's try and make that happen. So what we did is we're trying to put what we like a little focus group together. And I'll tell you, I'll make a promise that one of the things that I will try and focus them towards doing is once they start publishing bringing out some documents, some little consensus statements that are well balanced that we can send to these universities, I'll try and get a few of them to give you a heads up, because they're telling us that they can afford us some time to instigate change. Now, if that's the sort of person you're looking for, we've got some students over in Europe that I think could be able to help you out with a few things, whether that be for, like you said, reviews or for support or for some background checks, that I'm sure there's a lot of weight on your shoulders for that.
Yeah, especially while I'm in school, a lot of times I'm choosing between studying for something and doing some background research for an upcoming podcast. I've had some professors who've said, you absolutely need to continue doing this podcast. This is a great thing. And I've had a couple say, I can't believe you're devoting time to it. And my retort is, but look what I'm researching. You know, I'm not researching baseball statistics. A couple of them were like, well, why is there beer involved? I'm like, look, beer sets the tone for a conversation at the very beginning, and that's it. But I think a couple of them were a little older and were a little like put off by the fact that it was called the Pintcast. But I'm like, look, that just sets the tone. But the stuff that I've been researching has opened my eyes. The best information that I get from people is, hey, I heard your episode with Adam Meekins. Have you ever read any of insert name here before? And then I just go research that person. I say, well, this person sounds interesting. Let's talk to them next.
Yeah, so it just follows from there, doesn't it? And I think that's there's so many answers to the question as to why did you do Physio Matters. And one of them is, and I will admit that I couldn't afford the courses, especially I've just described about all that commuting we were doing. I certainly couldn't afford some of the things I wanted to do. And so I thought, how about I offer them something in return and see if they'll talk to me for a couple of hours? And so it literally was just a bit of a hijack, thinking if we broadcast this and it works, then great. If it doesn't, then I've just done a few interviews with people that I'm interested in talking to, and that really took off. But it focuses your learning, and that's why I really do encourage you to keep chipping away at it. As much as I've said before, and I will explain probably some more specific examples if you like about how it can be a bit problematic for not just you but also the student listeners. And I always say student listeners to Physio Matters need to think even harder almost than the qualified staff. But with your podcast, is the manner in which people have this license and this direct access to young minds, I think it's something that we probably need to give you more support as to how to best, as I said, calibrate that.
Because I could be proliferating the problem of putting someone up on a pedestal and letting them scream the loudest instead of questioning them. I could be doing that.
That's not but I don't for a second think that there's any fault necessarily can be parked at you there. I think it's difficult because the whole situation with how things work now is that if someone wants to keep their head down and hide, they can do. If they want to be peddling some sort of style or model, they can do, and they don't necessarily have any, there's no social process of rebutting that necessarily. There's no way of reviewing it. Twitter does that to some degree, but the loudest people on the more extremist side, the more maverick side, they won't be engaging on Twitter. That's one of the things I'd encourage with your listeners and your colleagues and your students and even yourself, is that have a little think and think, why is someone so loud and proud on Facebook but they're not on Twitter? Mm-hmm. Now, not all the time, but sometimes that might be because if you've got a popular Facebook page, you can monitor that and you can delete any dissenting voices. Good luck doing that on Twitter.
Right.
That's not going to happen. Now, some might say that, well, Twitter's just a really noisy place for the evangelist to live, and they just shout people down so they don't engage. And they've got a point to some extent. But at least the most that I speak to on Twitter that engage regularly are just wanting to try and tease out the truth or as close to someone's actual position on something as they can do. And so I think that the healthy dose of skepticism for anyone that's got some very out there ideas, but they seem to, why are they on Facebook rather than on Twitter? How are they doing that? And they also sometimes can just drown things out on Facebook as well. The unlimited character means that,
right,
character limit means that they can just post as much as they want unrebutted, and as soon as they get a rebuttal, they can just delete it, and that gets a little bit sinister really in terms of bias.
One question I wanted to ask, what is sophology?
Oh yeah, so sophology was,
I googled it. Yeah, you'd emailed it and said that was one thing you wanted to talk about. Sometimes we could be susceptible to sophology. I googled it because I was like, I gotta know the term. And then as soon as I googled it, I said, oh yeah, he's messing with me.
Right. So yeah, I will explain. So the science of sophology is something that I feel like I wish I could write a book about that no one would probably buy and I'd never get around to writing. But I'll explain what I mean by it. I'm not necessarily just pulling your leg there. It's something I've been trying to talk about. Okay. And I've been dropping it into Twitter and not getting caught up on it. So I'm glad you eventually, someone Googled it. So what it means is, in an industry like ours, and it can happen across society generally, we can all be susceptible to this science of sophology. I sort of say it's rife in the spoken word, but it can appear in print in various forms too. But it's basically the process of spouting jargon in a coherent fashion, usually pretty quickly, whilst hiding extremely bold claims. And it usually it's delivered by in a really confident manner. To any attempts to sort of counter that confidence and make the person on the other side of the conversation seem rude or ignorant. Now, I'm saying this as if sophology is a word. Now, sophology isn't a word. So sophology is something that I try and use to describe this concept of nonsense. Mm-hmm. Because sophology, amusingly, sells sofas. They are essentially a company that sells sofas in the UK that decided to call their shops sophology. So essentially it's nonsense, but what you'll find is that when people are spouting jargon, so they can talk a load of nonsense and then they can say, well, it depends whether you come at that from a sophological point of view. And because some people might find that jargon to be attractive, or oh, they must know more than me, essentially they don't question it when it's nonsense. I suppose the people that are best at it as well are the ones that mix jargon with lay language terms. And so they get, so those people get admired as someone that brings the science to the people. So, right. I mean, I can give an example if you like. I don't know if you want to, but sure. It might be a bit. So the sophology perspective on, say, a shoulder problem, right? Let me have a go at this and probably show you how good a charlatan I could be if I wanted to be. But so if I'm talking about shoulders and I was trying to say my piece about why my approach to shoulders is better than someone else's, right? So the problem with office workers' shoulders is the lack of rotation-based eccentric focal loading of the shoulder's posterior kinetic chain. It gets the oblique fibers of the inferior labrum all piled up. So when you think about the metabolic cost when that person tries to say get out of bed in the morning, no wonder they're getting all sorts of car crashes going on in the glenohumeral joint. You know, you've got to sometimes you just got to strip it right back, say to your patient, look, can you do a Lithuanian box squat with a diabetic dwarf under your arm? Yes or no? Yeah,
well done.
So yeah, so
now I get what sophology is, because that's
sophology at its best.
If you were to strip away every single word, if you would take a transcript of that, I would know what every word meant, not in context, but you slam them together and I'm just sitting there kind of nodding and following along. But you must be right, because all those words were really scientific, but then there were a couple that were lay terms, so it sounds like you can relate the science to the layperson, so it must be correct.
Well, it's so attractive. I mean, it's the idea of it's specious reasoning. It's this concept. It's making something seem so technical. That's a forceful amount of nonsense. I can't think this is what I've just said about what metabolic costs of standing, of getting up out of bed and stuff. It just sounds so attractive. So yeah, but then how is that then calibrated? So at first you try and say, can you speak a bit slower just for the sake of that? That makes no sense. But also the only way to calibrate that is to know that it's nonsense. And that's the hardest part, really. Or at least if you think about what, say, TV channels or radio shows would do, is that they would have someone that's got a, like I say, one side of the fence. The anchor doesn't necessarily need to know that that's daft, but they have a counter narrative on the other side of their shoulder. And we can't always do that. Certainly can't be doing that all the time with podcasts. But really what we can do is we can start thinking, well, those that are in the center, that are talking to each other, that might have disagreements, but there's nothing too radical. Let's give them a platform and let's try and find this middle ground together, because it can be very difficult. And so I call it sophology, and I hope it trends. I hope it takes off. But just this idea that we can't just let people go on and rabbit. Because if we did, then, I mean, it makes you money, I suppose. I've just shown I could probably do well sort of spouting that sort of nonsense at rapid rates. But it's not morally or ethically sound, and it's not fair, I don't think.
I'm glad you gave it an actual title of what it actually is. In America, we would call it baffle them with bullshit. You just keep shoveling bullshit at them until they won't. Nobody's going to come back and argue with you, because it sounds like you've got everything covered. And if you don't, you're just going to confuse me even further if I ask for any clarity.
But this is one of the most, and I have to really clarify this, is that the most part with people that will do this outwardly. So they'll be broadcasting this sort of stuff. They're not doing it because they're trying to spin a line. They're doing it because they really believe it. These aren't people that are doing it on purpose. They're not charlatans. These are people that really do say something like what I just sort of whittered, and they really believe that there's these specific causal links between these terms and that these things are relevant. The ways in which they have seen the world is the way it needs to be seen. And the only way to really try and help them to understand that is through them opening their eyes to consensus, also to science, and to understand that. And so that's why people do wave papers at them vehemently, is because they are clearly ignoring those things and they think they're onto something that others aren't. And I don't think that's necessarily fair. And there's loads of analogies that can be used. I mean, sophology is just one of many analogies I use.
Yeah, it seems more like a pendulum. The further we let it swing away from what you just described as the center, the less effective it's going to be.
For sure. And the more momentum it has when it comes back. Because the kickback, when that pendulum swings, as is the nature of inertia, it will genuinely just bulldoze its way back to what we used to do. So when we progress, if we try and kick against it and say we need to radically overhaul everything we've ever held dear, then when that fails, which it will, because no one changes that quick, it comes back with such force and it skittles a lot of things. And so not for a minute suggesting it's easy. We can try to help people to understand where the middle ground is, then we're all really doing a good job, and we'll keep getting it wrong. And I think people might be listening and thinking I'm being a bit of a hypocrite because they might not consider me a middle ground person. Because like anything, the middle ground is only relative to the person that's
who's standing on it.
So someone who might be left of center thinks they're in the middle. As soon as they think they're in the middle, they think that someone else is right of them. And it's very tricky. But there's certain topics that are just hard to sort of elaborate the middle ground on. Like manual therapy is one of them. We've had a lot of problems in my business, you know, with my staff and my colleagues. And it's very tricky to try and explain to them where the middle ground is. Because some people think they're in the center. And really, that's not where consensus lies. Question being, are we a scientific profession? And I think so. You know, most people want us to be. We sit within a medical sphere, but equally we have especially my game, which is the musculoskeletal game, that tends to be something that has so much complexity to it. It doesn't sit well within a medical model of certainly research. And so there's a lot of distance there between perfect systematic reviews of randomized controlled trials, and because of that it can be more complex. And so instead we've got to try and work together to work out where these analogies can best sit. The thing with analogies is they don't suit everyone. That I think is a better way of mixing, say, the science and the jargon with lay terms that people would want to use. And so that's why I use them an awful lot, not necessarily sophology being the best one, but in terms such as my good friend Mike Stewart would use with regards to patients, metaphors and stories to try and help them to reconceptualize something being a sensitivity problem rather than another. And I think that that's a good thing that came up in some of your other podcasts as well. The difficulty being that on your podcasts, and I really do enjoy them, there's sometimes two ideas and two people can't be correct at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so when I look at your back catalogue, instead of me looking and thinking, who do I like, who don't I like, I listen to them and I just think that, isn't it interesting that these there can be some overlap, but generally speaking, some of those guests can't necessarily be correct at the same time.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah. And it goes back to what we talked about in the beginning as a student. If you look at my podcast in a metaphor, we'll go metaphor, look at me as a student just rambling around a bar filled with, you know, people who consider themselves physical therapy experts. And I'm just walking around with a beer in hand and I'm just looking for somebody to talk to me. And I'm going to listen because they made eye contact and they know more than me because I have yet to graduate.
And it's perfect. Because unfortunately, that person ambling around the beer sometimes gets taken advantage of.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And I think one of the things that's interesting, you know, I said before about you criticize ideas, but they don't live in a vacuum. And so sometimes people get caught up on it. When I say about that, I suppose I should qualify and explain that when someone gets caught up in that, it doesn't mean that I then say, well, your position on dry needling suggests to me that it's inevitable that you're going to be a bad father. You know, that would be pretty outrageous, right?
That's just me making
a bold assumption on that human being. It's just rude. You know, there's nothing sane about that. But for me to suggest that, well, you've published an awful lot of material here on YouTube and several thousands of tweets here, and I'm gathering that your position on dry needling is such that it's this. Okay, so does that relate to your clinical practice? Is that what you tend to find yourself doing with patients? Now, I have made a judgment call there, right? I've made an assessment, but I've made an assessment based on what I've come to know of that person. And I think that as physios, we're getting a difficult spot now where we're doing that all the time, and it feels really normal, feels really natural, but we're doing it in public. And so when the going gets tough and we get to a disagreement, and it's a public disagreement, it feels really uncomfortable, and you feel like you're being judged personally, but you're not. You're being judged on the within the context that you've decided to put out there. And so for me, the amount of stupid hate mail I get, because I've decided to broadcast what is now 30 hours worth of material under my name and my company name, right? So if someone comes to judge me on that, that's a good idea, right? I'm asking them to judge me on it. If right. they were to cast aspersions about me as a person based on it and to misrepresent me on it, that's a bit odd. I don't necessarily think that's that difficult a line to tread, but others do. And when I try to be, if you try and strip me of my ability for humor or sarcasm, you're stopping me being me, and that gets really difficult, and that's where we sometimes run into problems. And I think with regards to why it came up on why we started with what we started with on your podcast is the idea that when there's problems with who can be more right than who, without a direct debate, the only way it can be calibrated is through an evidence-based lens. Yeah. and discussion around that. A classic example with my friend Adam Meekins is he's a Twitter personality that podcasts. I'm trying to be a podcast personality that tweets. Doesn't suit me necessarily perfectly well, doesn't Twitter. Generally speaking, I prefer the long form conversations, but from them, I'm allowed to take a stance one side of center. And when I do, it doesn't necessarily make me a moral monster.
Who says beer doesn't solve all problems? The PT Pinecast with McKay.
The PT Pinecast is powered by ptlive.me. PT Live wants you to know, we know you love ortho, but love doesn't always pay the rent. And let's face it, home health is, well, home health. Join PT Live's growing team of on-demand physical therapists working from anywhere, anytime, with anyone. Screen patients, help clinics nationwide, and next date night you can say, have the ribeye, honey. PTLive.me. We'll take it from here.
The PT Pinecast proudly supports the Wounded Warrior Project. Since 2003, the Wounded Warrior Project has been raising funds and awareness for the needs of injured service members, helping injured servicemen and women with aid and assistance, and to provide unique direct programs and services to meet their needs. Their continuing goal is to foster the most successful, well-adjusted generation of wounded service members in our nation's history. To find out how you can help the Wounded Warrior Project, visit them online at woundedwarriorproject.org.
Talking with Jack Chu of Choose Health. You can find him on Twitter at @choose_health. The Physio Matters podcast can be found on iTunes, and you can find a link to that on his website, choosehealth.co.uk. Saw this pop up not long ago. I'm pretty sure it was on Twitter. Evidence-based practice versus practice-based evidence. I looked at it and said, oh man, I'm going to have to sit here and figure this one out with a slide rule. But then once I started listening to the different sides of the debates, it started to look a little bit easier to understand. But then, oh no, I'm going to have to put this into practice once I graduate, is how to tear the two apart. So how would you explain evidence-based practice versus practice-based evidence?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a tricky one, isn't it? To try and elaborate it as a term, is that evidence-based practice is a fairly well-established term within medicine. And so the sort of definitions I don't want to butcher. But essentially the idea that evidence being scientific evidence, and so if we think about evidence-based practice within physics and mathematics, is much more straightforward because they find themselves landing on laws and rules. In physiotherapy terms, it might mean that someone who's vehemently for evidence-based practice, although they would be misrepresenting the term, there could be someone that's exclusively into research, or they were saying if it's not got a systematic review to suggest that that's the best way of doing it, then they're not going to do it. There's very few people that can function in musculoskeletal practice with that worldview, but that would be quite out there. It'd also be a misrepresentation of evidence-based practice. But practice-based evidence being that by experience and by practice, that would then mean that you would start to learn what works and what doesn't, which we all do. In doing so, by being really far side of said spectrum, you would end up really going for what has worked for you, and therefore ignoring when dissenting voices suggest that there's evidence to the contrary. You would be saying, well, it works for me, why am I getting such success? Because we work with, you'd never get someone that was doing practice-based evidence as a mechanic and getting it so wrong, right, compared to the evidence, because essentially they won't be fixing any cars, right? Whereas when it comes to people that work under a purely practice-based evidence model, the problem that you have is that they do have some success because they're working with human beings that if they were to buy into what they've been doing, then essentially they will yield some pretty substantial success, especially when it's delivered with such passion and conviction or under a sophological point of view, as we talked about before, then that's difficult for both for the patient to truly understand. And so you can do some pretty strange things that are counter to the evidence and still get success from them, as long as they're within safe limits.
For 3 years, it's hammered evidence-based practice, evidence-based practice. I finally, you know, maybe a year and a half in, started to get that, and then all of a sudden that twist of practice-based evidence, which I took as the, you know, turning it on its head, which would be, well, you've been in clinic long enough, maybe you've tried the evidence, that's not working, now you're just going to try something and, you know, fling it against the wall and see if it sticks.
Yeah, and that's where it gets very, very tricky, because I suppose, and I will use an example and elaborate, and then you, but essentially what's the really tricky part? If we try and put it into contextualize it with your podcast, because I can, because I've listened to a number of them, right? It's no fault of anyone's, but everyone tries to lean towards an anecdote or two, okay?
Right, right.
So you had a great podcast, I think you had a few people on talking about dry needling, mm-hmm. Okay? Now, in that podcast, they're going to naturally err towards practice-based evidence, because they've got a bucket load of anecdotes that happened that weekend, right?
Right.
Now, because there's these things that they're doing to people, and they're noticing these changes, okay, both in terms of what they might perceive to be tissue-based changes, neurological changes, perceptual changes. We've all had needles put in us and we feel certain things. And then you end up there with these bucket load of evidence. Now, bucket load of anecdotes. And they say that the plural of anecdote isn't evidence, right? And that's really difficult. The problem with it is that someone might come at that from an evidence-based practice point of view and just demonize the fact that anecdotes aren't evidence and suggest that putting needles in people, it does nothing, which we know is a very outrageous thing.
Right.
I suppose I'm accidentally plugging in our next podcast, which is talking about just that. We're doing some acupuncture. They're doing a podcast on acupuncture. The reason I mention it is because it was a great podcast that you had, but it's just that was practice-based evidence saying, look, we're seeing these things happen, therefore it must be true.
Do people go that way with practice-based evidence when there isn't enough evidence to back up their practice?
Great question. I think that sometimes that's the case. Yeah, what is the measuring stick? What is the way in which we can work that out? With regards to some forms of practice-based evidence, and I suppose I'd let dry needling be an example of that, is that if dry needling was as successful as is being touted by those that are really into it, who are deemed that to be a big part of their practice, then it would be quite unusual for that to not do so well in clinical trials. Although clinical trials do become quite sterile, there are problems with that. Certainly in the needling literature, it's very difficult to form a successful placebo control, for example. But it would be some of the things that would be quite difficult for it to not replicate some success. And that's what gets difficult, because sometimes people, it's just the absence of evidence makes them lean towards their experience. Totally sensible. I mean, I'm having to do that all the time because everyone's a unique person. There's a joke going on. I work half-time, part-time now in the NHS over in the UK. And in doing so, we say that we see the patients that get ruled out of the trials. They're the ones that don't meet the inclusion criteria.
Right.
We see people that have got all sorts of other comorbidities. And so we joke about the fact that we're still leaning heavily on the evidence when we're helping those people or assessing those people, because you're leaning on the mechanism-based evidence. And so I said about analogies, I will start to finally get to my point, is that I use analogies and metaphors trying to explain my position on certain topics, because it can be a shortcut to getting it understood. So I put one together recently for manual therapy and palpation, because defining the middle ground with that has been very difficult, because on one hand you've got what I'd call extremists telling us that they can feel misplaced vertebrae, slipped SIJs, thickened fascia with their elbows, And then from those findings, they can correct the abnormalities with their hands with various sharp and blunt objects, right? That's a fairly extremist view. And then on the other hand, you've got what I'd call evangelists, who then they wave these inter-tester reliability papers, claiming that any palpation finding, aside from what's expressed by the patient, is an illusion, and that the concept feel or palpation sense is deluded. This perception of palpation, this really touchy-feely, I can feel this, is usually coupled with the despondent attitude towards that sense of palpation is usually coupled with a stance that there's no skill whatsoever in manual therapy, aside from the ability to apply it safely. I mean, that's usually granted. But generally speaking, they're the two ends of a spectrum. The general gist is that I use the analogy that that's like learning to drive. Learning to drive a car on the road is a skill that's learned by, say, linking various different skills together. So, for example, you don't learn to steer independent of learning to accelerate. And, of course, learning to drive isn't about making binary decisions. You don't just think about turning left. It's about how much you turn left, or how quickly do you turn the wheel? How fast is the car already moving at that point? The way that you then use the way that you know things about the world also helps you to learn to drive a car. You wouldn't learn to drive a car straight off the bat. That's why we don't have 8-year-olds, fortunately, driving around. There's a certain level of human maturity that's required. Okay, so I could use an analogy about a clutch, couldn't I? But you guys all drive automatic cars. Don't you? do you drive stick?
I learned on a stick, yep.
Okay, well, I use that analogy particularly over in the UK, because if you think about a way that a clutch works when you're driving a manual car, that's all about feel. Good luck trying to ridicule that, you know, that you're feeling for that. And that sensation now, but I'm using it as manual therapy and palpation here, because you learn about palpation and manual therapy in a combination of skills way. So try palpating an asymptomatic hamstring with the same technique, pressure, hand position as, say, a symptomatic lateral ankle, and you won't make any friends.
Right.
So you're going to start poking on a sore ankle as you would a non-sore hamstring. You just wouldn't do it. So everyone knows that. The reason I like this analogy particularly, because it begs the question, what about the brilliant drivers out there? They're incredibly skillful. And so to suggest that and to suggest a comparison means that those who practice and train in palpation and manual therapy for years and years and years, they'll be able to feel what most people can't feel and correct what most people can't correct. But here's the caveat. I think that is true to some degree, in the case that if you palpate someone and practice feeling bodies for years and years in similar ways every day, of course they're going to be able to feel more than I feel. I think it's intellectually dishonest to suggest they can't feel it. If you think about how our sensory system can be trained, like, have you seen those people that can balance stones on stones on stones on stones?
Right. They're just good at it.
They're practiced. And it's something that, unless you're really good at that, forgive me if you are, but it's something that we wouldn't be able to do, right?
Right.
We'd have to practice a lot, and it would seem we'd be practicing it, and we'd be seemingly not able to do it. So I think that although there is a case to be made, and I'm into my adventure sports, and so there's some people that can, they know exactly where their skateboard is at any given time through their shoes, their socks, and usually a bit of blood, and they can still feel where the board is. So there's something to be said for that. But when it comes to driving a car, the Formula One drivers, those with amazing skills, they drive just like Joe Bloggs on the road, because they have to drive within the confines of the law.
Right.
They can be brilliant drivers, and their skills might stop them having accidents or whatever, but you struggle to tell them apart on the road because they have to live by the law. Let's say they are living by the law, for example, in this circumstance. Now, manual therapy has some hard and fast laws in the shape of physics. So even if I politely grant you the idea that, say, someone often says, like, I felt the fascia is tight in the anterior superior ITB on the left side, the forces required to do anything about that with your bare hands are far greater than what you can achieve without striking someone.
Right.
Or if you feel that someone, say, C5 is laterally displaced, I mean, I'll let you have it. For the sake of this, I'll let you say that you can feel that, right? Like balancing stones. But to specifically manipulate that segment and to move it back the perfect amount that it was displaced, and then it stays put because you asked it nicely to, I'm really struggling. That just isn't what we think happens when we push, pull, and crack people. The evidence might change, the practice-based evidence might come through, or we might understand the mechanisms differently. But and this is the difficult thing, it would take the science to go an awful lot, a long way backwards, or we'd have to change our mind on a whole host of different things for that to even matter. And so, of course, manual therapy is a skill. Of course, palpation is a skill. But there's evidence provides a code of conduct. And then there's good old Isaac Newton, who lays down the laws of to what you can actually achieve when you do things. And so when we bear those in mind, I use that analogy to say, when you're saying someone's claiming to be physiotherapy's answer to Michael Schumacher, they're just doing the equivalent of speeding, and they're dangerous. And right. I know that seems a bit out there, but if someone's suggesting that they're doing things to other human beings that is just doesn't seem true from what we know, then that can be really deleterious to those patients and to society generally, that starts to feel quite fragile or quite needy.
That's a good example of how to separate the two.
That's a hell of a long analogy, and I'm sorry about that, but it's just a way in which, not jargon, but where science can try and meet analogy in a certain way, but hopefully it makes sense as to how that might offer some measuring stick as to the fact that, of course, when you're feeling something, like if you're doing a Lachman's test, you're relying on feel. So if someone was to say that anything you feel with your hands, you just can't trust it, that's not going to help you with your career. For what is one of the most valid and reliable tests that we have in our armory, it's not going to be helpful if someone was to poo-poo everything that you felt. But equally, if you were to then rely so heavily on feel, and you were to suggest some of the very out there things I've just mentioned,
right,
then essentially it might guide your treatment to be something that you think you can instigate changes on people that you can't. That can be really difficult and really, really tricky. So using analogies as best possible.
It's good for me to hear you talking about some of the people claiming to be the rock stacking experts of manual therapy. I've run into a couple of those people, and I remember thinking, am I ever going to get as good as this guy? And then there's also, because I'm a skeptical New Yorker, thinking, is he just kind of just blowing smoke too? I mean, he's probably just doing this because he knows I'm a student, and there's no possible way I'm ever going to say that I can feel the difference between, like you said, a laterally displaced C5. Then he manipulates and he's like, well, now you can feel it's back in place. And I've been standing there saying, you're just messing with me because you know I'm a student, and I'm not going to have anything to come back at you with.
I feel for you there, mate. I'll tell you what, I think it'd be unfair to keep, we talk about ideas and we talk about people peddling ideas and stuff. And I think it was really enjoyed the podcast that you did with Kelly Starrett, for example.
Right.
And I think that when Kelly was on, it was one of the first times, because I've heard a lot of his work and I've read his book. And I think it was the reason I found that particularly interesting podcast, it's the first time I've heard him come back at some rebuttals that he'd had before. So he's saying that people would say that we don't know what normal is. And so he said, I don't care about what normal is. I want full normal. Right, I want someone to have the full function. Now, again, that's something that I know that you could tell that he really believes in, really passionate about. And I think that that's a really understandable position, considering, like I said, having read his book, and his position on these things is fairly clear. Lots of YouTube videos, etc. It's an interesting sort of take on things, though, isn't it? Because if I went to my accountant and said, I'm having some problems with my finances, I'm struggling to do things myself, I want to start a business, but I want to concentrate on my business, will you be my accountant? They say, yeah. Well, what would you like to achieve? And I said, well, I want a physiotherapy practice, and we can start to try and grow things. I want to do things a bit differently, and I've got this podcast. If my accountant turned around and said, no, you want to go more. You want to go all in. You want to be Google. You want full normal. You don't want to try and function as a physiotherapist in business that just manages, okay? That's irrelevant. You want to go all in. You want to be the best you can be all the time. And I think that that's one of the difficulties that occurs when it comes to this idea of, I'm not trying to correct normal, I'm just trying to get someone completely full. And if they don't have 20 degrees of hyperextension overhead of their shoulder, then they're deficient. And tell them they're deficient, that's where it becomes problematic. And so that reason I really did enjoy that podcast is because it's the first time I've sort of heard him come back at some of the obvious things. But even so, it was done so with a misunderstanding. And so you see, the only way to try and come at that is to come at it with other ideas.
I see what you're saying. Each episode is a pint, and before we're done with the pint, we take shots. So if there's any parting shots of wisdom that you'd give for practicing PTs, or for someone, I don't know, like me, who's going to graduate in just a couple of months, fingers crossed.
Congratulations, mate.
Well, don't jinx me just yet. I haven't passed the damn test. What would those parting shots be? Something to keep real close while I'm heading out into the, quote, real world.
The first shot being try to find your middle ground on the spectrum.
Okay, I like that a lot.
We talked a lot about spectrums, didn't we? And then the second thing is if you happen to find yourself in a position where you're passionately embarrassed, which is what I describe myself as, then essentially that's an okay position to be in. Be respectful, be polite, but stand your ground and understand you can achieve things by questioning things. Just do so politely, but you can really have strong views but loosely held.
I like that. Short, sweet, and to the point. You can check out his podcast on iTunes, the Physio Matters podcast. Going to go into episode number 28 very, very shortly. Check him out on Twitter at @choose_health, and his website is online at choosehealth.co.uk. More information available about Jack Chu. Appreciate the time, man.
So yeah, you're doing great work, mate.
Thank you. Appreciate the time, and hope this isn't the last time we talk. And again, happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
And you, mate. And I'll go and crack another.
Sounds good.
Thanks a lot. Cheers, man.
Follow us on Twitter at PT Pintcast and online at ptpintcast.com. It's like TMZ, except with way more important information. And no Miley Cyrus. Okay, it's not like TMZ at all. The PT Pintcast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.